WPWK, brought to you by Klipsch Audio. This is WPWK with producer, engineer, Eddie Kramer in the studio.
Hello, all.
And 1969 was a pretty important year. You had moved to New York City the year before and working at the record plant. But at the same time, Jimmy was about to build his own studio.
Yes, that was a kind of a strange thing how that occurred, because 69 was a year of change for Jimmy and also for the country at large. A lot of things happening in America. And he had decided, after many months of jamming at this one particular club called The Generation, which was in the Village on 8th Street, he was jamming at this club and having a good old time, and the club wasn't doing too well, and it closed, and Jimmy decided with his manager, let's buy the club and I'll have a club where I can jam, which they did. And then it was still sitting vacant for quite a while, and then I got a phone call one day. They were starting to do the basic drawings for the nightclub, and they said, well, we need a recording studio, a little tiny booth in the back would do fine, a little 8-track machine. And I walked down into the space, which was The Generation, and I looked at it and I said, you guys are out of your freaking minds. Why on earth do you want a nightclub? You know, Jimmy spends most of his time in the recording studio and spends about $300,000 a year recording. Why don't you just make, why don't we make the best recording studio in the world? And we did.
Yeah, you did. Electric Lady Studios.
Yeah, which it took about a year to build and cost about $1 million in 1969-70 dollars, because we didn't open it until March, April of 1970. Mm-hmm. It took a year to build.
And then he was kind of able to really experiment if he wanted to and not have to worry about the clock ticking and the dollars racking up and paying by the hour or the day rate or whatever. Now, at the same time, you really wanted to make a transition from engineer to producer, I'm sure, as every engineer, great engineer, wants to do. They don't want to just be sitting there pushing the buttons. They want to be making some decisions as well, which you were already doing that as an engineer, to be fair, as well. You were collaborating with Jimmy,
yeah.
But he was listed as producer. Fair enough. It's, you know, his album. But who was the first artist you were able to produce?
Well, at the end of 1970, you know, Jimmy died unfortunately in 1970 in September, but towards the end of that period, I had started work on an album with Carly Simon. It was her first album on Elektra, and I produced that album and engineered it. It was my first attempt at really doing a pop album, and it was a big challenge for me, because never having worked with a female artist before. And there was a lot of ground rules that I didn't really quite understand. And my role as producer and as co-writer on some of the songs, it was a difficult transition for me, I think. But I think the album turned out really well. There was a hit single called That's the Way I've Always Heard It Should Be. Actually, one of my favorite tracks. Mm-hmm. I think sonically, Electric Lady Studios, where we were working, was a big part of that, and has since, you know, Jimmy and I put the studio together and recorded there, and so many artists have recorded there, and today, to this day, it is still a wonderful sounding studio. Just magically lucky, I guess.
And Carly also won a Grammy for that album for Best New Artist.
She certainly did.
Carly Simon, produced by Eddie Kramer, who is here in the WPWK studio with me just now. Beautiful, beautiful, beautiful song, and something very different, you know, because you're usually associated with a lot of hard rockers, and that's a very tender kind of song. Not that the other band that you work with couldn't do tender, because they certainly could, which I'm talking about Led Zeppelin. They had
I've never heard of those geezers. Who are they?
Yeah, only like the biggest band in the world in the early 70s. But they had heard your work with Hendrix and were really impressed. And, you know, I mean, I love Led Zeppelin 1, but it is quite patchy. You know, when you listen to it sonically, it kind of sounds like one song sounds completely different than another one. And so they're recording their second album, and they're kind of recording it piecemeal while they're on tour. And I guess they, you were their kind of Mr. Fix-It.
I guess so. I never thought of it that way, but thank you. That's great. Oh, Mr. Fix-It, I can just see you coming in with a big toolkit. Yeah. Yes, let me see. Yeah, because we had to do tracks in New York, and we found this little studio called Juggy Sound. And Juggy Sound was a small little rectangular box. I remember putting Bonzo, our lovely drummer, Mr. John Henry Bonham, down at the far end, and there was a little vocal booth, there was a little bass thing and a small little section to put the guitar amps, and it was all very tight and nice, and it was cool. And one of the tracks that we cut there was a song called Heartbreaker, which I think is one of their really cool, tough little songs. And the guitar solo, which everybody loves so much. I mean, it's a brilliant, brilliant, because every guitar player wants to quote that. But we actually overdubbed that. That's cut in from an overdub I think we did at A&R Studios, where we actually mixed it. We were in there the day before we mixed, just doing some quick overdubs. And he brought in this little tiny amp. It was a Rocket Ampeg amp, you know, with a 10-inch speaker, just plugged it in, go, right, done, thank you. And then, you know, obviously I had to take that solo and cut it in to the actual master when I'd mixed it, so yeah.
So there's a lot of post-production on that album. I mean,
and
you guys did it in 2 days? Didn't you do a lot of the mixing down in 2 days?
The actual mixes were done in 2 days, but prior to that, I'd done, in fact, Moby Dick, I had cut a completely new drum solo, which is also cut in. So,
oh my gosh.
I mean, it just was all over the place, but somehow we managed to make it all seamless.
And the different sonics from the different studios and trying to match all that, that's a lot of work. But luckily, by the time they got to Houses of the Holy, which was a kind of a what they were calling those these huge concert venues they were playing. I mean, they were they were definitely the biggest band in America. I think we Americans actually embraced Led Zeppelin more than the British. And
eventually, the British got it.
Eventually, they did. Yeah, but I'm always surprised that I know more about Led Zeppelin than most Brits. It's like I couldn't get a high school diploma without knowing the first five Led Zeppelin albums. But with Houses of the Holy, was a much different story. I mean, the band were at the top of their game, playing these massive concert venues, which they dubbed Houses of the Holy, and they went to Mick Jagger's estate, Stargroves, and you engineered the album there from a mobile 16-track studio.
I remember the office in New York, Steve Weiss's office, who is their attorney. They called me up and said, "Oh, the boys want you to come over to England to do some work with them." Oh, yeah, all right, fine. Get the plane, go over to England, and discovered that they'd rented Mick Jagger's house, mansion, called Stargroves, and the Rolling Stones mobile.
And which they had recorded Exile on Main Street on.
Correct,
previously.
It was a lovely truck, actually, and they had a Helios board, which sounded fabulous. But the cool thing about Stargroves was the fact that I could put Bonzo's drums in the conservatory, which had a sort of semicircular shape and quite live sounding. And then, you know, Jimmy Page's guitar could be either in a drawing room, or we sometimes ended up putting it inside a fireplace and dropping a mic down. And, you know, the John Paul Jones's bass would be in another room, so we could always get good separation, and that was the idea.
And different room acoustics and reverb times.
Different room acoustic, different reverb times, and the idea being that if you wanted to overdub something, you wouldn't get the interference from the original track. But they always played so tight together. I mean, the precision with which Bonzo and John Paul Jones locked was just amazing. And of course, Jimmy Page being the producer, director guy, I mean, with the vision, in which he really did have a strong, clear sense of where's the song going to go, what's it going to sound like, what's the end result. And Robert's voice is just phenomenal. He just wails.
One of the best voices in rock, period.
Oh, this is great.
It's one of my favorite Zeppelin albums, and I think it's kind of underrated, actually, because so many people say 1, 2, or 4 are their favorites. And for me, this one, it seems like the band is very relaxed. They're at the top of their game. They're having a great time. They're not touring. You know, they're in this beautiful estate. I mean, what was the vibe like?
Happy, which was unusual. I think they were having a good time, and I think we all did. Being out in the country away from all the sort of pressure of London and all the clubs and all that, the lads were concentrating on the record, and they seemed to be in a very relaxed state of mind.
Mm-hmm.
One of the tracks that really shows that, I would say, is Dancing Days, which is one of my favorites too, because I remember we had just finished cutting the track, and everybody was so buzzed about the track, and we had the truck door was open. It was a lovely sunny day, very unusual for England, little daisies out on the lawn, and we cranked the speakers and we were playing it back, and Robert and Jimmy decided to dance, and they invented this little dance for Dancing Days, and it was just so joyous. You know, everybody was into it. My assistant engineer, John Paul Jones, the whole band was dancing.
You're listening to WPWK, Keepers of the Sound.
Now, one thing I love about Houses of the Holy is the whole variety of sounds and the different kinds of music on there. Because you have, like, that song's kind of light, but still kind of heavy at the same time. There's funky. It's really quite funky. There's a reggae influence. It has the regular rockers as well. But it also has
Exactly.
And there's a real delicacy as well, especially with one of my favorite songs, which we'll get to. But I guess, I mean, when you have Jimmy Page and John Paul Jones, who are prolific.
Seasoned session musicians.
Seasoned.
And I think that the this influence you were referring to, which is Jimmy Page grew up listening to British folk music.
Like Bert Jansch.
Bert Jansch, who was a fabulous guitar player, played acoustic guitar, and that was a huge influence on him.
On every British guitarist.
On every British guitarist. But I think Jimmy really took a lot of those sounds that he was making and incorporated that into the Zeppelin sound. The fact that Jimmy could play mandolin and 12-string and 6-string and loved acoustic instruments, and I think John Paul Jones did to a large extent. So when the two of them would play together acoustic guitars, it was always very magical.
And one fact that's quite interesting, which I learned, is that Jimmy Page was on about 60% of the top 10 hits in a couple of years in the middle of the 1960s. I mean, he was working on so many different records, so he had to be very versatile, just like John Paul Jones. They really had to step into any situation, learn something very quickly, and then and produce something and really...
Read it once and play it.
Exactly.
So I can remember John Paul Jones walking into Olympic Studios with his bass over his arm and the charts, because he was a bloody good string arranger, under his arm and wheeling in a B-15 amplifier, coming into Olympic, standing up in front of a 60-piece orchestra, put the charts on the conductor's rostrum, plugging in the bass right next to him. We put a little screen around that. He would stand up there with the bass in his hand and hold it up in the air and conduct the whole orchestra with the bass in his hand with his arrangement. It was just genius.
Wow.
There was another session where both Jimmy Page and John Paul Jones were on, and it was a song by Donovan called Hurdy Gurdy Man.
I love that
produced
song.
By Mickey Most, and I remember that session very clearly. So that's how I met them as session musicians, before Zeppelin, before any of that.
WPWK, brought to you by Klipsch Audio.
Now, a band that was not always considered delicate, except once in a while they were, was another kind of long-standing relationship that you had professionally, but you met them quite earlier than before they became known as Kiss. Can you tell me the story?
Yep, there was this band called, before they were Kiss, of course, they were called Wicked Lester. And they did an album that was absolutely horrendous because it was them trying to sound like the Beatles, like that, and they couldn't really sing those parts. Anyway, the record went straight in the bloody toilet, and their producer asked me at Electric Lady Studios one day, could you do a demo for me? Gene and Paul want to do a new thing. It's a rock band, and it's not my speed, you know. So he said, would you do it? And I said, absolutely. So we dragged him into Studio B one day at Electric Lady and set them all up. And I remember Ace Frehley walking in to the studio, and he was so bloody thin. I mean, he was about as thin as this mic stand. He'd been driving a cab in the Bronx trying to stay alive. But they were playing around New York and doing very well as the band Kiss. And experimenting with the makeup. And I remember sitting there in the studio with them doing their demo, six songs including Black Diamond, all the, you know, the major hits, so to speak. And I looked over at Gene, and he's sitting next to me, and he's got this notebook, and in the notebook is a very accurate drawing of each of the characters with a description of what they're supposed to be doing in the band. So he had it all planned out. He was a very smart man, Gene.
Mm-hmm. He was a teacher before,
wasn't he? Can you imagine Gene teaching high school? Ay, 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 ay.
So anyways, you get a call a few years later about their live album.
The final end of the story would be, the demo got them the record deal with Casablanca. Mm. They did two albums. They went on the road and they sort of really pounded the pavement, and it paid dividends because they had about 200,000-300,000 fans, which they knew about. And I get a phone call from the boss of the record company, Neil Bogart, and he said, do you want to do a live record with Kiss? And I said, yeah, that would be kind of fun, but I need to call you back. And on my desk was sitting a tape of a band called Boston, and I called up Tom Scholz. Listen, mate, put it out. It's bloody marvelous. I can't really alter that. Mm. And
that was a smash hit.
That was a smash hit. So I got to work with Kiss and did the live album, and that was many, many hours in the studio because if you can imagine them in the boots and the explosions and the bombs and the fireworks, they're jumping up and down with their 6-inch boots or whatever, and nothing's really in time or in tune. So the result was that we had to overdub a bunch of stuff, which we did at Electric Lady.
So there was a lot of post-production. Now, meanwhile, the band, we're going to fast forward a little bit, the band had done like 5 albums in 3 years, are constantly touring, and the album we're going to listen to something from is Love Gun, which is the last album where all 4 original band members perform on each song. And then following this, they all did solo albums. And the band kind of started to disintegrate the relationships between them. So this kind of is a definitive Kiss album, Love Gun. What do you remember about working on this album?
A lot of hard work.
But it was good.
No, I mean, look, the boys worked very, very hard. And, you know, they came into the studio reasonably well prepared because they'd done a lot of rehearsals and stuff. It was just at that particular moment, trying to get them to play all together at the same time and tight and everything. Sometimes, you know, we would spend quite a few hours making sure the track was tight.
Klipsch Audio, pissing off the neighbors since 1946.
So they must have been quite entertaining to work with.
They were a trip. I never actually put on the 6-inch heels, but contrary to popular belief.
So you worked with them for 4 albums, was it?
I did 7 albums.
Yeah, oh my gosh.
Alive 1, Alive 2, Alive 3, right. Love Gun, and Rock and Roll Over, and what else? There was another one somewhere in there, I can't remember. But yeah.
Hazy Days.
Platinum, Double Platinum. Anyway, there was a bunch of them. They were very hard working in the studio, I have to say. And my favorite guitar player, of course, was Ace, because Ace, I think, was the rock and roll soul of the band. He was a bloody good guitar player, and I think highly underrated. He had his problems, but so did a lot of people.
Yeah.
But I loved his playing, and we later collaborated on his solo album when the boys decided to do 4 solo records. And his was the one that was the only one that was successful. Mm-hmm. The other three didn't do very well at all because we had a hit single with, Back in the New York Groove, which is still played today.
Mm-hmm.
hats off to, the whole band, of course, they were fabulous together. And Gene and Paul, really smart guys and really, they've become, it's this huge entity with the Kiss Army and all of that. But I just have this sort of warm feeling for Ace's playing.
Right.
The band was sort of in, let's put it this way, they were in transition. There were some internal problems, but we had to all sort of figure out how we're going to make this record. And let's rent a theater in Nanuet, New York, and bring the record plant truck in and all of that. And that's what we did. And we were in this theater in the round with a stage in the middle, which supposedly would revolve, but we made sure that the power was off of that. We didn't want them messing with it. But I just remember Ace coming in with an air gun and shooting out lights in the room. And, it was craziness.
These are the days of lots of money in the music business. Yes. The 70s. Yes. Wow.
It was definitely over the top.
Well, I want to say thank you so much for coming up, because after this, I think you guys are off on a plane, on a jet plane somewhere. Eddie, thank you so much for coming out to WPWK. It's been great hanging out with you once again.
Thank you so much.
All right, take care.
You're listening to WPWK, Keepers of the Sound.